All right, so we're going to go into our next session here, and Paul, would you like to make the intro?
Okay. Not my intro.
Tim and John. Are these all hot?
They're all hot, so don't touch them.
Okay.
I'll get burned. So, we're very happy to have as our second fireside chat keynote Tim Dubois and John Potter, who is a friend of the Rights Tech Initiative, and I will let John handle the introduction.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everybody, for having us here and spending a few minutes with us. I've spent a little time in the digital music industry back in an earlier life, and occasionally I got along with a songwriter or two, and Tim and I met probably 6 months ago.
Face to face.
Face to face, that's right. Well, he says he saw me in an audience and he might have thrown something at me. But it was a great discussion. A common friend of ours brought us together in Nashville after they let me into that city again. And for those who didn't see the op-ed that we wrote together in the Tennessean, it was really great because we basically said together, he's a songwriter and I've worked with digital services for a long, long time. The companies that are licensees want to pay money to the licensors. They want more money. Our guys, of course, want to pay less. The consumers just want their music. And there's always going to be food fights about how much money. But what we agreed on was the money that gets paid should get to the right person. The person who pays it should know it. And the person who deserves it should know that they got it. And it was actually really fun to work this out because we didn't have a disagreement the whole time we were writing together.
No.
Now, are we going to put that to music, and can I make some money off that?
Maybe.
But I think Tim's the only songwriter that's speaking today, and I think you might be the only pure creator that's speaking today, but you're also an accountant. You've also been a label head. You've been an ASCAP executive. So tell these folks a little about you and why it matters to you, why all of this techno-plumbing babble matters to creators.
Well, I've been blessed, or lucky, I should say. I'm trying to quit saying blessed. Been lucky enough to sit at almost every chair at the table. I started out as a songwriter. Actually, I started out as a recovering CPA. Okay, I'm a classic left brain, right brain conflict who worked for Arthur Andersen as an auditor, but couldn't quit wanting to play guitar and sing songs and write songs, and eventually ended up having the opportunity to do that after working as an accountant and doing all the work for a PhD other than this little thing they call a dissertation. Why I ended up in Nashville writing songs. I was lucky enough to have 5 number one country songs, a couple of Grammy nominations. I am the guy who wrote She Got the Gold Mine, I Got the Shaft, and then lost it to his ex-wife in the divorce. And so just throw that out as point of fact. I have had, I was talking to Linda Adele, who's a dear friend of mine from Nashville. I have had this situation of writing out royalty checks, calculating royalties, and collecting royalties because I have been a record label head, a record producer, and also a songwriter and a publisher. And it does all boil down to what John said. As a creator, we just want to be paid fairly, and we want to make sure that the money goes to where it is. And the reason that I think this room is so important to that is that the technology holds the key to getting that right. Anytime, and John and I have talked about this quite a little bit, anytime that money passes through an organization unnecessarily, I get scared, okay? And I have a right to get scared because I worked at most of those organizations, okay? and I know of what I speak. And if I could find, if I could develop a purely transparent way for a songwriter to get paid that came directly from whoever's using it, that would be wonderful. So that's kind of why I'm here today. And also to talk about the fact that, you know, this is an urgent problem, folks. In my last couple of years at ASCAP over there, to sit and watch what's happening within our writers' community is very, very distressing. When John was at DEMA and we were fighting all the time, this, that, and the other, most of my fight was from the side of I was still at that point in time running record labels. But I got to see what it's doing to the songwriters right now over the last few years when I was at ASCAP, and we have guys that used to do very well writing songs. It's the biggest people that get hurt the most, John and I were talking about this too, are the young writers that come in now, because the publisher flow is so much lower than it used to be because they don't make any money off the album cuts. They can't afford to invest in new writers like they used to. I was telling John that if you go back even 7-8 years ago, if a kid showed up in my office that I could see he had the talent, he had it, but he just wasn't quite there yet, he needed a couple of years of seasoning, he needed somebody really being critical of his work and helping him along, I could pick up the phone and call a half a dozen people there in Nashville, and they would offer him $2,000 a month to come write songs for him. That world no longer exists. In this short time, it's just gone completely away. Almost nobody gets a writer's deal unless they've already got cuts in town. And right now there's writer's deals being done with artists, I mean with young writers, where they're not paying them any kind of draw at all. They're basically just saying, I'll represent your songs. If I get something cut, I get half of it. And that's just not a good situation. So we're seeing things dry up pretty fast. That's why I'm here. Today I'm going to speak to you as a writer and as a creator and what it feels like from that side of the fence.
So Tim, when you started and you wrote a song, it got played on the radio, it got put into an album cut, how many different checks a month did you get, right? You got an ASCAP, you got a PRO check, you got a Harry Potter, you know,
When you're a staff writer, this goes back to the early 80s is when I had my first successes as a writer. Basically, there were two checks. Unless you got lucky and you got some kind of sync, well, that actually still got paid to you through the publisher. But you got a publisher's check, which was basically mechanicals at that point in time. And you got a performance check from ASCAP. And you know, I used to get a 8-page statement from ASCAP and BMI, and there'd be an $80,000 check attached to it. Now I get an 80-page statement from BMI, and I'm lucky if there's $800 attached to it. Now that's not very, you're giggling, but that's not very much of an exaggeration. And as a songwriter in the early stages, you don't really care. Most songwriters aren't accountants, okay? Songwriting career is not it's a calling, not a wise business decision. Okay? Most of the guys that are writing didn't get it there because they made a logical decision about what to do with their career. All they care about is what's that check.
Most of them got the shaft and wanted to write a song about it.
That's right. That's right. But it was very, very simple if you wanted to learn it at that point in time. Quite honestly, right now, I have trouble interpreting my own statements, and I'm a CPA, and I've said everywhere, but it's still very hard for me to get through. I'm still just getting a few checks. I do have multiple publishers, so I get different, but then I own a couple of publishing companies that I've, you know, so there's more checks there, but I don't do the accounting for it. Somebody else does. And for me to sit down and try to figure out how much money I made off of somebody in Sweden is not something that I want to do. I mean, do any of you all ever get to look at a royalty statement? I know Linda does, she's sitting back there. Do you understand what the hell you're looking at? I know there was a guy up here that offered to audit it for you and pay about, you know, figure out what it is. But I mean, it is so hard for the common songwriter or even the small publisher to understand exactly what's going on. And that's something that you guys, I think, have the power to clean up and to build a system that One of the things John and I totally agree on is the fact that things should be easier to license. We should be able to know who owns something, and we should be able to get them on the phone and negotiate a license. Right now, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars in almost every catalog that it's not worth licensing because the paperwork and the trouble of trying to find out who owns it and getting it done costs more than the license is worth. So nobody even pursues doing that kind of stuff. Correct?
You know, honestly, I don't spend a lot of time on licensing deals, so I talk to a whole lot of people who do. But yeah, we talked, I remember 18 years ago, Digital Media Association then was MTV, AOL, Yahoo, Real Networks, probably Liquid Audio, some others, and we went to the major publishers and we said to them, how about if all the money we owe you, we pay direct? Forget about mechanicals versus performances. Forget about Harry Fox, ASCAP, BMI, CSAC. We'll just write you a check, and we'll give it to you every 30 days with maybe a 30-day lag time. And you won't have to pay 15% or 18% to the PROs. Oh, and by the way, we're going to tell you every single time that song was performed or downloaded. Every single time. You're going to get terabytes of data. And every single major publishers said, oh no, thank you. No, really, ASCAP and BMI are our friends. You just keep paying them and they'll just keep sending us checks. Does that surprise you that that was the reaction we got 18 years ago?
No. No, and it's, I mean, we're still dealing with it today. It hasn't changed 18 years ago. If you go in and, I mean, I am an ASCAP member, have been for a long time. I have songs at BMI, all of my early works are at BMI. I worked as the head of the Nashville division of ASCAP for a couple of years. It is an entrenched system that is resistant to change, just as the record companies were an entrenched system that was resistant to change. And you know, it's going to take that breakthrough technology and some education and some changes in the copyright law, which I think, you know, the winds of change are blowing, if ever so gently, you know. And I think every songwriter and publisher, just their heads spun around 14 times when the DOGA thing came out a few weeks ago. But you know, I really have the belief in my heart that that's going to sort itself out, that that's not going to be the way it ends up, because it just can't. It's just too damn stupid. And if they knew what they were looking at, they would know what they're proposing just won't work. It just can't flat work. But the thing that the record companies and the publishers, you are threatening their world. And I had a front row seat. I remember the day that Strauss Zelnick, some of you may remember that name, was the head of BMG. And we used to have a quarterly president's meeting, and I was the president. By the way, I'm listed as the president of Arista Records on your program. That was a long time ago, okay? But back when I was president of Arista Records, we used to have these meetings. I remember the day that Strauss told us about Napster. And Kevin Conroy, who some of you may remember that name, came in and stood in front of us and gave a little further explanation. And then some MIT guy came in and gave a little further explanation. And I was sitting right there, and it was just like, wait, that can't be right. They can't just all of a sudden just take all this work that we've invested all this money in and just not pay anything for it and take it. And I remember being naive enough to think, these are very smart people. My God, Strauss Zelnick is a Harvard MBA. We've got these MIT engineers and all these guys working on it. They're going to figure this out and fix it. Uh-uh. We made it worse. You know, if you look back at the history of it, which now I've had the pleasure of doing and teach it, I teach at Vanderbilt in the MBA program there, and we talk about, you know, how crazy it was for the industry to do what it did. But we squashed the bug. The bug spread out and became a lot more dangerous when we did. You know.
So Hank Barry was right? Should have taken the license, taken the money.
you should have. But that's why my hope is and my belief is that technology is the answer to this. I'm not an expert on Bitcoin. I'm not even going to pretend to be at all. I'm not an expert on a lot of things, but one thing John and I totally agree on is there is technology available that will allow us to build that Uber database, that real-time copyright data that's out there. I'm working with a company called MyWorks, which has got a patented technology that's a copyright intake system, and it also works as a cleanser if you want to take data and plug back into it. There are several companies out there. Benji's just walked through the door. I missed his talk this morning, but I heard a little bit about it. You know, there's lots of people working on this, and you know, as a writer and as a creative person, I'm praying that we figure it out, and relatively soon, too.
So now I'll tell my first heard about Napster story.
Okay.
Which, for those of you who are old enough, you remember encoding.com, right before it turned into Loudeye and went public. Todd Sawicki on a desk in Seattle. He said, what's that? Larry, he said, you gotta see this thing, it's amazing. It's like, you can get any song you want. It was kind of crazy. It was amazing. And then there was people like Jerry Kirby, who not only blew up his vision and his mind and his brain, you know, blew up his company, he would say, because he was about to get those licenses. So you have in the audience, and having spoken today, several different companies, some with proprietary technology, some with great relationships, who think, and let's give them credit, let's say all of them could build, right, the plumbing. The technology to get the data from the copyrights in, the data from the, you know how your Samsung TV watches you at all times, right? Maybe there's microphones everywhere that are listening at all times, right? So all the songs, all the performances, all the downloads, it can know it all, right? The record companies and the publishers and the writers have to agree to play with those folks, right? They have to, and I will tell you that, because if you don't play, if you don't give them the data,
right,
then they can't do the job for you, with you, right?
Right.
Is that going to happen?
Well, it's going to take the right, in the early days of my works, and this may be some of the same stuff Benji's running into, you've got to get to the point that you get to a tipping point, that you've got enough information in the system to make it work. And in the early days, we went to BMI, we went to all the logical people. We went to BMI, we went to CSAC, we went to ASCAP. And we said, look what we can do for you, and we just need a partner with us to go forward with this thing. And we actually, literally, the technology that we have works on any kind of intellectual property. It's not just music specific. Anything you've got to pay royalties on, or research, or patents, or anything, that's what it does. But music was the thing where our background was. So our thought was, let's go get us a partner. A strategic partner that can help us roll this thing out.
And you knew some of these folks, like
I put together a 4-day, 2 days in New York, 2 days in LA, and we sat in front of high-level executives at every major record label, and there were a lot more record labels back then, and every major publisher in America, and presented this thing to them, basically saying to them, here, help us build this thing, and we'll actually give you this vertical. We'll give you the music vertical. We'll help you run it. We'll build it on our platform. You help us build this for music. We'll keep the other verticals, and that's how we'll go forward. And not one literally, I went into that thing so confident, and at the end of the week, my tail was so tucked under me, you couldn't see it, man. I got my head handed to me several different ways. By people that I knew, that I had relationships with. And it was just a time, now you gotta realize this was about 8 years ago, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood. And things have changed tremendously in 8 years. Yes, sir.
So I have a question. My name is Andreas Gephardt. I work with Getty Images. But about that part of the story, so was that just a matter of them not, oh, sorry.
Here, you can have this one.
Hello?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. So about this part of the story, when you said you went through all these and you pitched it to all of them and nobody was interested in it, was there a common theme why?
Yes. They did not want to spend the money. At that point in time, they were all very afraid of what was going on. They were pulling things in.
So if you were Microsoft and you said to them, we don't need you to spend any money. You just need to let us connect to your servers, would they have said yes or no?
I think they would have said yes, because almost to a person, everybody said, this is a really great idea if you get this built. Why, you know, I can see how it would be a great benefit. Good luck. Bye.
I'm gonna posit a different answer. I'm going to posit two answers. One is, number one, you have to give us equity if you want to even have free access to our data. Number two, and I believe this, particularly in the publishing world, they don't know what they own.
I totally agree.
They don't know what they own, you know, you can connect if you can connect to their index card file.
Yeah.
Because that's what they got when they bought all those publisher and sub-publisher. But that, and I will tell you, there are companies out there, some who are represented in this room, who have done deals with major publishers after being sued by them and given them very large advance checks, and then they said to the major publisher, great, tell us what we just licensed.
No, I have living proof. I know. I mean, there are major transactions of companies within Nashville, and I don't have to name names, you can figure it out. But if you walked into Sony ATV and asked them to find an Acuff Rose song, which they bought 6 or 7 or 8 years ago in their system that wasn't one of the top 100 earners, they couldn't tell you anything about it. That's how screwed up the systems are. And I'm not just picking on Sony. Every company's that way. Most of my stuff's at Warner Chappell. One of the Warner Chappell executives was in my office when I was still running Universal South, a record label. And I walked in just as a joke. She's meeting with my A&R person. And I have, like I said, 5 number one songs over there, some Grammy nominations, a CMA Song of the Year, a bunch of stuff. And I walked in, and my A&R guys jokingly said, "Why, how come you never pitched me any Tim Dubois songs?" And she went, "We publish you?" That's a true story.
And she kept her job.
I didn't tell on her. But I mean, that's what you're dealing with a major publisher. They don't know what they have.
I want to go down one more level, because we've talked about this, and one of the challenges that the DOJ was asked to address, and I don't want to talk about their decision being right or wrong, but one of the interesting challenges for writing is how many writers, right, and co-writers there are, and who gets the credit when those decisions are made or when they are formalized, right? And all that sort of, so the splits, if you will, the service licensing from the publisher is one thing, the publisher then paying accurately is another thing. I wanna just posit one other, so okay. IMDb, right? The Internet Movie Database, now owned by Amazon.com, mm-hmm. right? If I have this right, it's sort of a self-service, right? I become a member of IMDb and I say, oh yeah, I was the grip. I was the third assistant director on this film, right? Mm-hmm. And I get to populate it with my stuff.
Right.
How do we decide who are all the writers and who is getting enough credit or less? How do you decide that?
Well, in a...
And how do you memorialize it and then make sure the money flows?
Okay. In the world as it exists right now, And Nashville is very different in that there's a lot of co-writing, but it's pretty organized. There's usually 2 or 3 people. You don't see 14 different writers and the guy that brought pizza listed like you do on some other things. But it's basically up to the publishers to decide that. And in Nashville, it usually there isn't an argument. If you're in the room, you're in for an equal share. A word is a third is one of the sayings. And that's not as a creative, that's not necessarily a wrong thing, because sometimes the most important thing that happens in a writing session is somebody says, that's right, or that's wrong. And they may not contribute anything more than that, but it may be the thing that gets you over the hump and gets you to the end of the thing. So that's just kind of the way that it's done. As far as sorting it out at the publisher level, right now it's still very disorganized. Songwriter has to turn in. He has to turn it in. He keeps track of how many songs he writes so that he can get his contract. He turns it into his publisher. He says, this is my share. That they'll check that with the other co-publishers. That's it. And I don't want to turn this into a commercial for my works, but that's one of the things that my works does beautifully, because when you turn it in, it's basically like using social networking. As soon as we finish the song, if it's me and you that wrote the song, and what's your name?
Ned.
Me, you, and Ned, okay? It's John, Tim, and Ned. Today, all I've got to do is I go to my...
That was worth a third.
I go to my account and I basically push out to you an email that says, Tim Dubois says that John, Ned, and you wrote today, what the date is. This is how you spell Potter. This is how you spell whatever Ned's last name is. And D-U-B has a capital B. And you got everything, all the information there. If I send it to you and you agree, all you got to do is click one button and it's pushed out to your publisher and to your PRO and everybody else. You've agreed to the split. You've agreed to the spelling. You've caused, you know, if there is a disagreement, then you push it back to us. Just like, it's like, it's kind of like Facebook meets Wikipedia to a certain extent. You could edit things and send it back, but it bounces around between the three of us until we all agree, yeah, that's right. Okay, so we've now verified the data as far as we're concerned. Now that probably wouldn't be the three of us writers. That would more likely be the publisher or somebody in the office that's actually doing that. But that's the theory of it. Then you've got agreed to data that gets pushed down into the PRO system and into the publisher system that everybody's on the same page. And to take it to the next level, if you are lucky enough or unlucky enough to lose a copyright or somebody dies or whatever, all it takes is one stakeholder logging back in, and that change gets pushed out to all the other stakeholders. So it stays live that way. Right now, it's just a system that's very, I'm not gonna say it's haphazard, but publishers run way behind in logging things. Publishers don't usually bother with registering anything until there's some activity on it. And that's very scary, but that's just the way it's done. And they've got so many songs coming into them all the time that if they just sat there every day and did copyright registration, it'd be three full-time jobs for big companies. It's just not as organized as you wish it was when you're a creator. Most songwriters don't know and don't care that, like I said, if they're getting the check. Somebody asks, how do you get this to happen? In the music world, it's got to be the carrot and the stick. And the carrot, from the writer standpoint, the publishers, the PROs, or somebody has to force it on them. If you want to get paid, the publisher's the easiest person to do it. If you want to get a pay, you get paid your weekly draw, then you present your songs to me in this fashion. You get them in a timely thing. And when they're in, then I'll give you your weekly check.
We could keep listening to you guys forever.
I can talk more.
I wish we could, but we do have a schedule to keep to. Does anyone have a question? Maybe we could take at least one question before we go on here.
If anybody has any interest in my works, contact Linda Adele Howard right there.
All right.
I just
Linda,
hired
you've been retained.
Her earlier today.
let me make one final point. It is really actually a very happy moment, because for those of you who know the bullshit of the last 20 years, right, or the 10 years that I ran DEMA, one of the things we said very early on and said consistently was, what the only people that matter in this are the creators and the consumers, and the rest of us are just in-betweeners. And all the in-betweeners, or the entrenched folks as you describe them, right, they're well-armed, they're well-resourced, and they're really happy with the way the business works today. And I think one of the hardest things was for the consumers to connect to the creators and to find that place of alignment and agreement. Putting aside whether it's a dollar or it's $100, what matters is that the dollar gets to the right place, or the $100 gets to the right place, and then it gets there with fewer bites taken out of it before it arrives. So I want to thank you, Tim, for doing this. I want to thank you, Ned, for hosting us, and we'll do it again.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.